and welcome to Season 3, Episode 3 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Drs. Justin Winzenberg and Stephen Jones. In this podcast, we look to explore truth, beauty, wisdom, and goodness at the intersection of faith and scholarship. We'll introduce those themes further in today's podcast. Then we will continue with part two in the first of several series in which we look at Justin's dissertation. This first series focuses on biblical scholarship and empire studies. And in today's episode, Justin sheds light on the Roman imperial context in the first century. But first, here are our highlights, lowlights, and insights for the week.
So what are you drinking for coffee this morning?
Well, actually, I was going to ask you, how's that gooseneck working out?
You know, I just brought it in this morning to the office and everything is working out great. It's a pretty good cup of coffee. I'm enjoying it.
So did you do the pour over today?
I did do the pour over. So I had to do some research again. I've been doing pour overs before, but I had to do some research on exactly the grind of beans that you're supposed to use. Mm-hmm. But I tried it out this morning. It worked out really nicely. Although it does take a little bit longer than me walking down to the coffee shop here and grabbing a cup of coffee.
That's true. And you don't get the exercise.
But that's true. Oh boy. Don't get into that. That's going to give me even more incentive to stop making my own coffee, which I just determined I would be doing. It's working out good.
Is there still there used to be a computer lab outside your office door and then it was kind of a study area. Is that still what it is?
Yeah.
So I would think that you making that coffee in your office has got to drive some people nuts. Like suddenly they're finding themselves hoofing it down to the coffee shop.
See, now that's probably true. I was wondering if you thought it might drive them nuts if I have like a grinder in here and you just hear. But I grind the beans at home and then I bring them in because I figured I don't know if my colleagues, even though the people on both sides of me are wonderful people, whether they would appreciate the coffee being ground in the office.
Now, the real key is you're under the library, right?
Yeah.
So you got to have somebody go up and listen while you grind the beans and see if they can hear it in the library. And if they can, then you know it's just you can't do it.
Yeah. So that's the coffee I'm drinking. What about you?
Yeah, I've got here at the office, we've got this nice automatic coffee machine and it's just so consistent. I think that's the thing so it's the kind that grinds the beans and then, you know, does the water and then it discharges a puck of grounds afterwards. And yeah,
nice.
It's just, I don't know. I like the consistent fresh ground taste. It's nice.
Now that there is something to that because doing pour over or anything like that, it really can be inconsistent if your grind is a little bit different in terms of the beans, or if you don't measure it out the same every time.
Now, I do have to tell you, earlier today we were, because we're what, 7 hours ahead of you, right? So Jenny and I went to a coffee shop earlier today to study, and I thought I was getting a mocha, and this has been a problem, like finding a mocha here. I don't know why. We're really struggling with finding a mocha. And so I thought I had ordered a mocha. It was called a mocha presso, right? So in my mind, this is like chocolate with espresso, but it wasn't. It was just a hot chocolate and it was very sweet. And it was not actually what I was looking for. It was good, but it was good for what it was, but it wasn't what I wanted. So still on the hunt for a good mocha here.
You might have to make one yourself.
I might have to. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's a highlight been for you this week?
Well, as I came into the office, you know, our semester starting up here again today. And as I came into the office, I remembered a couple Christmas presents that I got and that I'd forgotten about that brought a big smile to my face. It's going to be a little bit difficult to visualize here for our listeners, but I'm actually going to show you what this is. This is one of the most bizarre Christmas presents I've ever gotten.
All right.
And yet it brought joy to my face. What it is a picture of a soldier on a canvas, a small canvas. And instead of the soldier's face, it has the face of my cat on it.
Oh my goodness.
My cat, like my wife custom had this thing made with my cat's face on it, on the head of like what's supposed to look almost like a Roman soldier here.
I brought
this into the office. And the best part is not only did she make this canvas for me, but she also made a custom coffee mug.
No
with
way.
The exact that same is fantastic. Image on it. So I'm in the office today with my custom picture of my cat on the body of a Roman soldier. It is something else. It is
Can we get a picture of that for the website?
Yes. Yes, for sure.
I'd love to put that in the show notes. That is, yeah. That is wonderful.
That is my highlight. How about for you?
My highlight is getting back into the podcast, actually. Like as I was going through the last week and doing some editing and the conversation we had last week, and then looking forward to talking today, I just realized, yeah, I missed that in the fall, which I don't think that I could have in the fall, because we were so much in all of the transition, yeah. Everything. We're still in the transition process, but yeah, it's nice to recover something, get back to something familiar, and yeah, I enjoy it. So, yeah.
Well, I feel the same. So that should be a highlight of mine too.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, if I had a cat on a mug, a soldier cat on a mug, that would have to be a highlight. particularly if it was my cat. I don't have a cat, but yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, which cat is this?
This is my cat, Jerry.
Jerry. Okay. I know Jerry. Jerry.
Yep. Yes. He's gray. Yep. You know, Jerry. He looks very regal in this picture too. So I'll be excited to share it with our listeners.
That is the most dressed up I've ever seen Jerry looking.
So what's a low light for you then?
A low light for me, I think today it's just that it is so dark and cloudy. So it's 4:30 in the afternoon now, and it has felt so it's now considerably dark out. It's not night yet, but 20 minutes it will be, but it's been dark since at least 3 o'clock and it never really got light today. And that's kind of typical. We have a lot of days like that, but today was a particularly dark day, just literally dark. And so I don't mind it so much when there's some drizzle with it. There's something about that that I like. It's kind of cozy feeling, but when it's just dark, I don't know. It's like, all right, can we, I think part of it is you get to the end of the day and it feels like, well, I guess we just get ready for tomorrow then. Like, and by the end of the day, I mean 5 o'clock, you know, it's like, all right, exactly. I guess the day's over. So yeah. How about for you? What's a low light been?
Well, I was going to say quickly, I can sympathize with you. I got in the car today and it was really cold, and I've got one of those remote starts that's built into it, but I forgot to start it up. Oh. So I got in, it was really cold and I'm like really it's cold. Like, out.
What's the temperature out?
So yeah, it was really cold. And then on the radio, they said, yeah, we're at -9 degrees this morning.
All right. And this is Fahrenheit, right? -9 Fahrenheit.
Yeah. Fahrenheit. And I thought, yeah, that makes a little bit of sense then why I was so cold. we were at -25 last week or so. And then the next day we were at 30 degrees. So it was a 55 degree difference. That's in 24 hours. but my low light, my low light, I don't really have it well developed here, but I did have this realization, and I feel like I maybe talked about something along these lines before. So I apologize to our listeners if they recall me thinking about this before, but you know, about my kids were just hanging out in our living room and I didn't have much work to do or anything, but I found it a little bit tricky. My kids are 5 and 2, about two. I found it tricky to, at this age that they're at, know exactly how to play with them. You know, it's kind of like you're dad and you want to spend time with your kids, but I don't get easily as jazzed about building the little train set or something, or playing with the Paw Patrol toys or things that my kids would be doing if they're in the living room.
Right.
And so a low light is just this realization of how difficult it is sometimes when your kids are at an age where you're just so far removed from being interested in the kinds of things they're interested in, to at the same time show them love and want to spend time with them and hang out with them. It's not that I never do it. I do. And there are times where it's great and wonderful, but there are other times where it feels a little bit harder. Have you ever experienced that?
Oh, before? Yeah. I mean, that's super familiar. And yeah, sometimes one of my kids will tell me about something that they care about, whether that's, you know, and mine are a little older. So sometimes it's video games, or sometimes it's a show they're watching, or, and they're trying to explain sometimes these really complex stories. And I have no context for it. And I'm like, I'm making myself listen because I care about you, but I have no idea what you're saying and I don't know what it means. And I feel kind of like a jerk because I'm like, even when I say making myself listen, I mean, it's like, it's an act of the will. I don't want to hear this story, you know, but I care about you. And so I want to hear what you have to say. Yeah. So I don't know. It sounds familiar.
That's good. And then I'm not alone in it, but I feel like I want to get better at spending time with them, doing the things that they enjoy, even when they're enjoying it in their 5-year-old and 2-year-old minds.
Right.
And they're not interested in the things I'm interested in. Yeah. So I want to get better at that. But that does sort of lead into an insight for me as which is, it's not really more of an insight as much as a lingering question of how to, as a parent, do better, especially knowing that there are going to be things in your kids' lives that they're going to be excited about that you just may never enjoy. And I remember hearing from friends and talking with various friends whose parents, you know, when they were growing up, didn't have an easy time taking an interest in the things that they were really excited about, because maybe their parents were into athletics, but they weren't, or they were into athletics and their parents weren't, or they were into drama and doing plays at their school, but their parents were never interested in that because they like to go fishing or something. And I always thought about my own parents, how they were very good with just coming to everything that I did and at least appearing interested, even if internally they weren't. And that's something I always really appreciated. So I thought, man, how do you kind of develop that relationship with your kids to where there are going to be times you're like, I'm not interested in this. I wish they would do something that I was maybe more interested in, but then still just committing to being, finding ways to be interested in it anyways.
Well, and then the flip side of not like living vicariously through them either. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But not feeling the need to pressure them into doing the kinds of things that I did as when I was a kid or that I thought I would have done. And then just letting them be who they are and letting them enjoy the things they enjoy. And if they take an interest in obscure things that I just could have never imagined being interested in, is finding a way to generate some excitement for them with that, to let them know how excited we are for them. It's, I don't really know how to do that. It's something I think I'm going to have to learn.
There is something about, I don't know, like it's really, so I mentioned kind of the negative side of that, you know, where it feels like that disconnect, like you mentioned, but then there's also this, almost this sense of wonder, right? Of like, wow, I never even would have known that that was a thing to be interested in. And sometimes it's really cool, the things that they find. And
that's cool.
Yeah.
I wonder how much time we spend as parents sometimes fantasizing, you know, when your kids are really young, fantasizing of all these things you're going to do with them when they're older. And they usually, I'm guessing, just from my own experience, they take the shape of the kinds of things that you're interested in.
Right.
You know, oh, we'll play ball together. Well, you know, you don't really fantasize about, and what I mean by fantasizing is just having these, you know, these ideas of when my kid grows up, you know, we're going to be connecting in these ways. And I think a lot of parents can experience disappointment when they realize that my kid's not into that.
Right.
Yeah. And so then how can you turn it into a way to connect, you know, relationally, even when they're the things that you're maybe not particularly all that interested in.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense.
So I don't know if that's an insight or not, but anyhow, how about for you? Do you have an insight for us this week?
I think so. One of the things that has stood out to me this week is I've been doing some creative work, which is one of the things I like about the role here, is that there's both space for that and even the expectation for that. So one of the roles of our group is to intersect with artists and creatives, both from the US and from Berlin. And so one of the expectations for us as staff is that we're engaged creatively. And so I enjoy that. It's something I really like. And I think though the insight for me is just how much time it takes to both to produce things, but also to develop the skills to produce things. And so like I'm learning a few new tools right now for doing some video editing stuff. And I've started doing some painting with my daughter. That's one of those things that, I had not really ever done. But it just takes a lot of time to, and sometimes it's like, I know what I want to do, but figuring out how to do it and learning the discipline of figuring out how to do it is just demanding. And I think just that sense in which, I don't know, creativity takes time, I guess is my insight. And it's not necessarily, I think here's the thing for me. Sometimes the creative insight I have very quickly, I know what I want to do, but actually being able to bring it into reality, it just, yeah.
Yeah.
So kind of a...
No, I was totally expecting, our listeners can't see this, but you got a set of headphones on, and I was totally expecting that you might say that you've been hitting up the Berlin nightlife and I've been DJing at a few clubs in the area.
That's my new creative endeavor.
Yeah.
I think that's actually shut down right now with COVID. I don't think there's much
true,
going
that's
on.
That's true. Yeah. 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 Yeah, and that's it's such an interesting thing to think about. I feel like I don't have a lot of artistic bones in my body when it comes to things that are traditionally associated with the arts. I guess I can play music a bit, but I don't paint. I'm a terrible drawer. My wife does, and her work is fantastic. But so I don't have that in me. Poetry, no, but I don't feel like I'm poetic at all. So I feel like I'm so limited sometimes in particular arts that I could even do. So I commend you for taking up painting.
Well, thanks. Yeah. Somebody told me once that it was important for me to do things that I'm not good at. And that counts.
It does. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
So one of the things that we're doing this year is kind of trying to provide listeners a little sense of where we're headed, what we're doing in the podcast.
Yeah.
And that was something also that came out of the conversation with our patrons over the summer. Somebody asked the question, so what is this podcast about? And we're like, we're just a couple of profs in rooms getting coffee and talking about what we would have been talking about. But we kind of landed on these ideas of truth, beauty, goodness and wisdom. What is that? Why did we do that?
Over the course of the last about 3 months, I've come into contact with these quite frequently in light of some things that we've been thinking through at the college. And I started to realize that these are some pretty solid sort of classical educational concepts that a lot of institutions are engaging with. And the themes themselves have been around forever. These are things that educational institutions have been engaging with and invoking for a long time. And as you and I were kind of talking through those themes, it sparked our interest. We thought, man, these are some very interesting things that relate to podcast episodes we've done in the past, but also some things we'd like to do for this upcoming season. So our main motivation for engaging those themes were that they popped out at us as things that could be really intriguing themes to address in the upcoming season.
I think the other thing as we were talking through those themes is they really resonate with the context that I find myself in here in Berlin.
Yeah.
Yep. And even how being here lends a different perspective to those four themes.
Yeah. So I've been engaging them in the college, in various ways, and you've been intrigued by them being where you're at and thinking through the ministry that you guys are doing at Envision, and also how those themes are reoccurring things that are popping up within your own context in Berlin.
Over the place.
Yeah, we found them to be an interesting point of intersection. This isn't something we'd planned in advance, but as we were talking about some of the things that that we've been thinking through here, we realized that it was kind of a nice intersecting point for things that we're both reflecting on at the moment.
And it may be worth kind of just like connecting the dots. I think, starting with this discussion of your dissertation is not just an exercise in, hey, here's something that we have already done the work on or whatever, but really it is an exploration of truth in particular. So as I'm thinking about your dissertation, you're looking at the question, what is the truth of what this book says and how do we know that? And then there's intersection also with wisdom there of, what principles do we apply and how do we think well about this? But
yeah. And I think in the wisdom portion, I think is fascinating to think about with my dissertation. We can maybe talk about this later, but because of what I end up concluding about my subject, I really envision like a context in the first century world where early Christians were having to do a lot of discerning between the message that they're getting about Jesus and their context that they're living in, where there were alternative messages floating around, and not just floating around, but being constantly, fed to them and embraced by them at various points throughout their life. And so the wisdom component isn't just, okay, well, there's a truth component. What's true? What's not true? What's the reality? spirituality, but the wisdom component was really about a practical living in light of the Jesus narrative that they were encountering in their own context. There's beauty components too that we could get into as well that I think are way too often overlooked.
Well, especially in biblical studies, I mean, in the eschatological pieces. I mean, there is rich beauty in there. And then what does it mean to live well, to be good in light of those truths?
Yeah. So I find these themes also to be very, very relevant for biblical studies and for the ways that we engage the scriptures. And for a long time, I think maybe the only way that that scriptural conversation has ever been framed is through ideas of truth. What's true? What's right? What's objectively the case with reality? Where these three other themes that we're addressing throughout the season also are intersecting with biblical studies now in ways that people aren't often articulating. And so I think there's room and space for us to talk about how things like beauty and goodness and wisdom can actually also be a part of the way we engage the scriptures.
I think I'm especially excited, and I don't know if we'll get to this season or not, but something I really am looking forward to kind of teasing out is the intersection between truth and beauty.
Yeah.
And even the way that the way that there is truth that can be communicated non-linguistically, that various approaches to beauty give us access to. And this just feels like a really rich area for inquiry. Well, I think what it all boils down to is that there's a lot for us to explore at the intersection of truth, beauty, goodness, and wisdom. And then particularly as we're coming at that from the perspective of both faith and scholarship.
Yeah. Yep. And scholarship and ministry.
Yeah.
So we think about, you know, this is, I think, what started the conversation for us is me sharing with you a little bit about what we're doing here at Crown and how jazzed I was about those themes. And then you had this like, oh man, these are things that we deal with every day. And so that was that intersection that we saw saying, hey, why don't we just use these kind of classical educational themes as a way to have some conversations this particular season about things that are intersecting in our lives with those themes and with our interests. So
yeah. We'll be back in a moment with the conversation about Justin's dissertation. As always, you can find more at profsinrooms.com or join the conversation at patreon.com/profsinrooms. So we were talking about empire, specifically the Roman Empire, right? Which is what you're looking at. And there were three examples of empire that you give as you are trying to kind of figure out like what is in the dissertation working through. What am I talking about with empire?
Yeah.
Can you explain those?
Yeah. And to be clear, the ones that I picked, I only picked because they were particularly relevant to the conversation as it relates to Ephesians. I might have to explain this later when we actually look at Ephesians, in that there were many other components of what the Roman Empire was or what its ideology was that I could have selected. But I picked three that I thought were the most pertinent to the conversation that scholars have been having, or might add, haven't been having about Ephesians, but that they need to have. So one of the big claims that's made is that, well, the New Testament ignores the Roman Empire. It doesn't ever mention it. And some of the anti-imperial readings have said, well, you don't need to mention it in order to challenge it. In fact, what it's doing is it's coded sort of critique. In other words, so the critique is hidden in the text.
And so then the question would be, is there any reason why a first century author of the, you know, what ended up becoming the New Testament would have wanted to code their language?
Bingo. Exactly. Yeah. And actually one pretty famous scholar named John Barclay, he came out and he said, look, there is no reason, there is no danger for Christians in the first century that would mean that it would be necessary to code critiques of Rome, because you could openly critique the Roman Empire without it being dangerous.
Okay. So then you're looking specifically at the question of, is that accurate?
Correct. So what then I ask is, well, wait a second. Is that true? Is there any evidence that there was some danger associated with subversive writings in the first century that might necessitate them to have had to code critique if they were to give it? So what I look at are treason laws, essentially. Like what would cause someone to be accused of treason in the Roman Empire? And what's interesting is that there are developments in the early Roman Empire, where there are some emperors who, you know, you could openly critique them and you wouldn't be in danger of much. And then there are other emperors who are so sensitive about this that they make some incredibly odd laws about what would constitute treason. And so I highlight some of those and I say, well, what's interesting is that there are some points in the early empire where carrying a coin with the emperor's face on it into the latrine would have been considered treason.
Just having it with you.
Just having it with you. Yep. And a lot of people have acknowledged, now this is probably not what's usual for most emperors in the first century, but you have to acknowledge that at least for some it was, because we've got these stories of this happening. All this to say, I highlight all these possible things that could constitute treason. And one of the things that emerges is that there was certainly a sensitivity to anti-imperial sentiments, so that the emperors would put a lot of things in place in order to ensure that people would be prosecuted for such treasonous sentiments.
I mean, I think two of the things that really stood out to me were what could count as treason. And so one of the things that was mentioned was this idea of diminishing the grandeur of the Roman people.
Yeah, and especially eventually the Roman emperor.
So that's super broad, right?
Oh yeah. In fact, when these laws developed, it was essentially seen as sort of a slight to the superiority of the Roman people.
Interesting.
So if something was done that would seem to challenge the superiority of the Roman people, it could be considered treasonous.
Well, and so this was one of the second ones that stood out to me, was that praise of someone deemed unworthy could count as treason.
This was particularly of interest for me with Ephesians, because here's the truth. No place in the New Testament does it come out and say, hey, Jesus is this and the Roman emperor isn't. Mm-hmm. And the Roman emperor's ambitions to bring peace to the world, et cetera, are all false. That would be a pretty explicit critique of ideas of the emperor. Mm-hmm. But what I uncovered when I was looking at these treason laws was that there was one point where this author was writing a history, and eventually his writing was considered treasonous. And all that the person said was that Brutus and Cassius were the last great Romans. Now, the reason why that would be considered treasonous, if you're not hip with Roman history.
I have to confess, I'm not.
Well, I'll fill you in. Brutus and Cassius were the ones to basically initiate the assassination of Julius Caesar. Mm-hmm. That might not be considered a treasonous act in and of itself, except that all of the emperors that came from the first emperor until the fifth emperor were on the lineage of Julius Caesar. So what you're talking about is you're talking about somebody praising the assassins of the emperor's ancestor. Mm. So you see, what's interesting is what they don't say is, oh, Julius Caesar, you know, was a tyrant. What this person said was that the persons who killed them were the last great Romans. So that's where I discerned this act of treason, at least that this person being accused of treason wasn't saying anything explicitly against the emperors, mm-hmm. but he was praising people who were deemed unworthy of it, and it was counted as treason.
So then this becomes really interesting when you look at somebody praising Christ, right, which is what's happening in Ephesians, yep. and the question of, is it safe to praise someone who was executed by the Roman Empire?
Yeah. Bingo. That's it. And that's where I end up taking this in the long run, although it's a little more loaded than that. And I don't want to get too thick in the weeds here, so stop me if you think this is irrelevant. But the reason I bring this up in particular is what I essentially argue is that during the Pauline era, during the era where Paul's alive, it isn't that dangerous to be writing things that are anti-Roman. But what happens is, after Paul dies and a new imperial family comes to power, the further we get into the first century and then into the second, it becomes more loaded, because you start getting the development of these groups that are appointed by the emperors, or that emerge, that basically are their reason for being there is to hunt down subversive and treasonous tendencies.
That was super interesting. The spies and informants; these are two different groups of people, right?
But let me tell you why I'm even engaging that, though, and that's because there's a lot of dispute on whether Paul wrote Ephesians. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying is, if Paul wrote Ephesians, he wouldn't have probably needed to code anything. But once the ideas emerge within scholarship that maybe Paul didn't write it and that maybe Ephesians was written, say, at the end of the first century. What I begin to argue then is I said, well, if that's true, if Ephesians is written that late, guess what? The Roman circumstances change and the need then to code becomes more significant. So basically what I'm doing is I'm playing out this idea that the anti-imperial readings of Ephesians become far more loaded if Paul didn't write it.
Mm-hmm. By the way, what is that? So this is, you know, clearly outside of my field. What does a non-Pauline authorship of Ephesians do as far as understanding of canon scripture?
Yeah, I mean, it depends. It depends on your view. So just to throw my cards on the table, I have very little reason, like some scholars, to question the authorship of Ephesians as written by Paul. And ultimately, my real sentiment is, even if Paul didn't write it, we absolutely need Paul to read Ephesians because his name is slapped right on the front of it in the first verse. But what it does to canon is, in other words, what does it do to our view of scripture if it's attributed to Paul but not written by Paul? Well, one of two things. It could be considered a sort of forgery. And in that case, it might mean that it's not worthy of being included in the scriptures. Or, and a lot of people have acknowledged this, or writing under somebody's name was a conventional thing and not seen as disturbing or deceptive, and maybe doesn't say much. Maybe all it says is that some early Christian writers who we could consider authoritative were purposefully writing under Paul's name, and everyone understood that they were doing so, and that it's still as much scripture as anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on your view on it, really. I'm not really all that concerned with engaging that question. What I'm interested in saying is how a person conceives of the authorship of Ephesians impacts the plausibility of it being anti-imperial.
Got it. That makes sense.
Yeah. So that, and the reason I actually have this conversation is because it's everybody who says that Ephesians wasn't written by Paul that also says that Ephesians is in favor of the empire, not against it.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yep. And the reason is because they'll say, well, there's that section in Ephesians 5 that talks about, and 5 and 6, that talks about how the household should look. And everyone says, that's typical Roman household stuff. In other words, the author of Ephesians, the not Paul author writing at the end of the first century, was trying to show that Christianity in Ephesus was very much in line with Roman ideals of the family.
Got it. So you're bringing this in to say, hey, if this is your view of the authorship of Paul, it actually makes it even more likely that Paul is writing in critique of the empire, not in the direction that...
Correct.
Yeah, got it.
That's one big claim of my dissertation that I think is challenging the sort of assumed consensus about Ephesians. And that is that if it's written later and not by Paul, it is actually more loaded in its criticism of the empire than less loaded.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
I wanted to look at this next section. You have this discussion on imperial cults. Why are we looking at imperial cults?
Well,
and maybe probably a quick definition would be helpful.
Yeah, let me clarify the imperial cults, because when we hear the word cult, we often think of it as pejorative, you know, as if it's trying to make a statement about the invalidity and illegitimacy of the particular religious expression. So we think of how some, you know, Christians will speak of Mormonism as a cult, you know, or we think about any of the other cults that might exist in the 21st century, which we see as being these sort of, you know, mindless people who are just following after something, you know, unnecessarily in a particularly unhealthy form of religion. What I mean by cults and what the field in New Testament studies means when they refer to imperial cults is not pejorative, although is it an illegitimate expression of the worship of the one true God? No, but what's meant by it is the system of rituals designed to pay homage to and worship the Roman emperor, imperial cult. Now, the reason why it's not called emperor worship and it's called imperial cults is because it's also the truth that sometimes the systems of rituals expanded beyond just the single emperor and also involved the emperor's family or the Roman Empire at large. So what it is it's the deification. It's the making the Roman emperors and the Roman Empire into a god. And so we know that this happened in various ways. There were actual temples that Rome gave its stamp of approval on that were established, especially in what is now modern day Turkey, that were designed for people to worship the Roman emperors, especially the deified emperors who had just passed away. But then there were sort of smaller systems too of worship where this wouldn't necessarily be done in a massive temple, but could be part of the rituals that were conducted in households or just in public. And the reason I look at it is because, well, number one, when publications started emerging in the 80s, especially that were not at all related to New Testament studies, but looking at how these Roman rituals functioned, what it did was is it basically dispelled the myth that this form of worship was strictly religious and not political. Because for a long time, people were saying these were just silly, you know, primitive folks who they maybe didn't really believe the emperors were gods, but they were just doing religious stuff. And it had nothing to do with politics. What the publications came out and said was, no. This is an ingrained political religious sort of reality where it's all intermeshed. And this would have affected the world of early Christianity. The reason why I look at it is because if we're going to examine whether the claims about Jesus and Ephesians challenge ideas of the Roman emperor, one of the places we ought to look for those ideas is within the systems of rituals designed to worship the emperor and the emperor's family.
I want to read a little excerpt from your dissertation because I think there's this little passage you have that I think the enormity of what could be being believed or conveyed in these imperial cults is really important to get a handle on to understand what you're talking about.
Sure.
Okay, so you say, these imperial cults in Asia Minor projected cosmogonical, which is origins of the world, cosmological, which is ordering of time and space, and eschatological, which is arrival of the pinnacle of history, claims that supported wider Roman imperial ideology. These included claims of the eternality of Roman rule, the apotheosis of the empires, and the reordering of civic time and space. I think I like this because it's like, well, so what else is there? I mean, obviously at the social level, there are different things, but this is like saying that these imperial cults are making claims that extend to everything.
Yeah, that's what's important. And I think that's why the developments in imperial cults that happened in the 80s were so important, is because it said these aren't just making religious claims that are completely removed from the political realities of their time. They're making claims about the very origins of the world, about how time itself is ordered, and about how the arrival of the pinnacle of history happened. So the Roman imperial cults are basically projecting these grandiose realities that we would consider theological to the people across the Roman Empire. And they're making the claim that at the center of those things is the Roman emperor and their family. Mm-hmm.
And then there's this question of what is it like for Christians to interact with that? And you say that it's not necessarily that the authorities were imposing that, but that there was pressure from local people.
Yeah, that's important as well, because we sometimes have this false idea that during, say, the mid first century, so Paul's lifetime, he's out doing missionary journeys, but they're going into these cities and there are these edicts against Christianity and edicts saying, if you don't worship the Roman emperor, you know, you're going to be persecuted. And what I suggest is that's a mischaracterization. Now, that might happen at a later point in Christian history, but during the time of the New Testament, we're not aware of that having occurred. There are some smaller persecutions that are happening in various cities that we're aware of, like in Rome in the 60s under Nero. But ultimately, it's not like the people from Rome are saying, hey, I want everybody to do this, and if not, I want you to persecute them.
But that doesn't mean there isn't this pressure, right?
Correct. Yeah. What you do have is, you know, you got to keep in mind too that a lot of the system of Roman rule worked off of things like relationships. So what you would have is you'd have the city, you know, that's a ways away from Rome, and you would have people who were instituted either with Roman authority or that they were local rulers that the Romans sort of gave their stamp of approval to. And there was a lot of pressure from those regional authorities to maintain a solid relationship with Rome. And so Rome might not be sending them a message saying, hey, everyone worship the emperor or else. But the local authorities might say, we don't want to look bad. We don't want our city to look bad to Rome. We want to be in a proper relationship with Roman rule. And so when people aren't paying homage to the biggest expression of Roman rule in their area, which may have been, if they were lucky, a temple to the Roman emperor.
Lucky in the sense of like that, that's how they would be perceiving, like, it's good for us as subjugated peoples under the Roman Empire to have a temple to Rome. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. And actually it wasn't granted very often in the first century. So there were cities that would compete against each other. They would propose that the Roman Empire or Roman Emperor would allow them to set up a temple to worship, say, a deified emperor who had died or a living emperor. And what Rome wasn't doing at that time was granting it to every city that wanted one. Mm. So what would happen was, if you were lucky, your city might get one of those. And then it made it that much more important for those regional authorities to ensure that the face of the city, you know, is saved in terms of, you know, expressing their allegiance to Rome by participating in those rituals. Mm-hmm. But even when those massive temples didn't exist in a city, because not all cities were lucky enough to get one, there were other forms of rituals publicly and even privately that they could do to pay homage to the emperor. And there must have been some social pressures to participate in that. Otherwise, it might look bad. Mm-hmm. Or it might just mean that there isn't, and that not everybody in the city has sort of bought in, to Roman allegiance.
Which in some cases could be a big deal, right? Like you said, that in some places, the unwillingness of Christians to participate sometimes led people to thinking that they were atheists, which is fascinating, but also this idea that they were inviting destruction on everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. And keep in mind, I think there's this general idea in the Roman world, because polytheism sort of ruled the day, the idea that you worship the many gods, that when there was some catastrophe that happened in a city, there was often a sentiment of like, well, maybe the gods are mad. And then the question would be, well, why are they mad?
And if there's a group of people not paying homage at the temple or at the imperial cult.
Yeah, that could be an explanation.
Yeah, interesting.
Now, I'll tell you this. The reason why I address this whole subject is because something fascinating is relevant for Ephesians in particular. Ephesians, you know, the city of Ephesus is kind of on the corner of the western edge of what is now modern day Turkey. Mm-hmm. And what's fascinating about these imperial cults or these systems of worshiping the emperor is that they exploded within this region during the first century. Mm. In fact, when the first emperor comes on the scene, Augustus, he's extremely savvy because he knows that his adopted father, Julius Caesar, was assassinated because he gave off the impression that he had too much power. And so what he does is he doesn't go about then saying, hey, I want everybody to worship me. He's not that stupid. He doesn't want to end up like his adopted father. But what happens is you get all these cities over in the east, modern day Turkey, you know, east of Rome, that are wanting to show their allegiance to Augustus. And Augustus doesn't say, all right, everybody, you have to worship me. But he starts granting a few cities here and there the privilege of having a temple to Augustus and to Rome.
Interesting.
But when Paul's alive, if Paul wrote Ephesians, there aren't many cities in this area of the world that have those grandiose temples. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't other rituals in place. Like I said, some local ones, some public ones or private ones. But what happens is at the end of the first century, it explodes even more. So and Ephesus actually gets multiple temples to the emperor.
So again, if it's not Pauline authorship, then Ephesians looks even more anti-imperial than if it is. Is that?
Well, I do eventually claim that. But what I say about the imperial cults is that most people want to dismiss these as relevant to the conversation about the empire in the New Testament because they say they just were pretty insignificant during Paul's lifetime. So to interpret Paul's letters, these things shouldn't be considered. What I say is, okay, here's the problem. A lot of people believe Paul didn't write Ephesians. And if Paul didn't write it, what does that mean for the recipients? Mm-hmm. Who are living in an environment where these now have exploded in their region. Mm-hmm. And what I basically say is actually now what that means is these need to become a part of the conversation in a way that hasn't been acknowledged because, and it's not because scholarship in general is in favor of Paul having written Ephesians. It's about 50-50, but it's because this part hasn't been even engaged in the conversation.
Gotcha.
If Ephesians challenges the Roman Empire, it may well do so to recipients who are living in an environment where the worship of the emperor has now increased significantly over about a 40 or 50 year period than what had existed in the early parts of the first century.
So what if it is a Pauline letter, or you know, what if Paul is the author, right? Like what does that do as far as the discussion of the imperial cults?
I think what's true then is that some of the recipients of the letter to Ephesians, if Paul wrote it, may not have ever seen a temple to the emperor. What that means then is to see these as significant might not be as relevant as has sometimes been acknowledged. But one thing I bring up in the conversation is look, even if they're not experiencing these massive temples to the Roman emperors and their families, there are other sorts of rituals that we would consider imperial cults that do exist publicly and privately that they may not have been pressured into, or if they were, it might be by local authorities, but that most definitely would have projected to them ideas of who the emperor was.
Or even the pressure of like social pressure, right? Which I think is probably important to acknowledge as a very real source of pressure in some situations.
Oh, it's as important as any official edict, because it's actually far more likely. We don't have evidences of edicts being sent from Rome of, you know, worship the emperor or else. That doesn't occur till much later. And so then the question is does that just mean that there is no pressure? Mm-hmm. Oh, what I suggest is, well, these local authorities, they may well have been pressuring to some extent. And even if there wasn't a full-out temple to the emperor. So I kind of put it on a scale. I say this. I said, well, how relevant are what these cults are saying about the emperor to the recipients of Ephesians? And I say, well, if it's written during Paul's lifetime, they're relevant for these reasons. If it's written after Paul's lifetime, they're even more relevant.
Gotcha.
So I don't say they're irrelevant during Paul's lifetime, but I do acknowledge, hey, look, it's not like this is in every city to the same extent, but I think we can safely say that the ideologies expressed in these cults about the emperor were alive and well, even in the Pauline era, that would have made claims about Jesus that are strikingly similar to have felt like challenge to the emperor. Mm-hmm. But in the end of the first century, this would have been felt even more.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. Reed Peters is a recognized patron of the show. As always, you can join us at patreon.com/profsinrooms for more conversation and bonus content. We hope you can join us for coffee again next time.